Welcome to Tantra Talks. This podcast is brought to you by Tantra Labs and hosted by our CTO, Russell LaCour. Please note, all opinions expressed by Russell or our guests on this podcast are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Tantra Labs, Inc. You should not treat any opinions expressed by Russell or our guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of their opinions. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Previously only open to accredited investors, Tantra Labs will soon be open to the public, offering 12% interest on your Bitcoin or Ethereum. That's higher than our competitors and much higher than your bank. To learn more or to sign up for our beta waitlist, visit tantralabs.io. All right, now back to the show.
All right, well, thank you and welcome back to Tantra Talks. We're going to be doing our Frequently Asked Questions Part 2 today. Looks like we're picking up on risks and specifically counterparty risks. Kagan has happily volunteered to answer some of the questions we have, so I'm going to go ahead and we'll jump right into it. Kagan, did you have anything you wanted to say before we talk the talk?
No, I'm ready. Let's dig in.
All right. So one of the questions that we get a lot is how do we vet our counterparties? So like the exchanges that we might trade on, or if we're lending from somebody else, how do we know, you know, whether we can trust them or not?
Excellent question. Yeah. And this is a great kind of secondary question to what we covered in the last pod, which is just about how do you make sure a trade doesn't lose a significant amount of money? And so this is going to cover how do you make sure a counterparty doesn't lose a significant amount of money on your behalf. And one of the main things that we look at is how they abide by their local laws and jurisdictions. So if you look throughout history, you'll see that there's been a lot of shakeups in the exchange world where exchanges have had to move their operations. And so we like to see them operating in jurisdictions that we understand. So for example, China has a little bit of an overreach, and so does the United States. And so if an exchange is not complying, you know, with specific KYC laws, which is know your customer laws that the United States requires, we want to make sure that they're not letting US people trade on that exchange. And so a lot of these exchanges will ban the access of the exchange by an IP address. So that would just be they can tell if you're coming from United States or one of these restricted areas.
A good example of this actually is BitMEX, which I'm sure everybody followed the news article if you're listening to this podcast, where all the three founders of BitMEX were named in a lawsuit drafted by the CFTC, I believe, where because they were, according to the lawsuit, allowing U.S. traders on without complying with U.S. law, they were all basically served. And I think one of them actually ended up getting arrested. I don't think the other two have been arrested yet, but it's a very serious thing that we pay very close attention to, how these exchanges are dealing with certain customers in certain jurisdictions, BitMEX being a prime example of maybe being a little gray in the beginning, and they're paying the price for it now.
That's a perfect example. And we've seen it also with Binance and a few other exchanges where they've really had to kind of pivot. And so we like seeing that pivot. And we also, in that same vein, we will not trade with a counterparty who doesn't KYC us. If something does go wrong, our name is on the account. And so we will have a claim on the funds.
And so let's roll into this too, because I think using BitMEX as an example, the way that they handled that situation was the three parties named in the lawsuit effectively stepped down from their active roles at BitMEX, or I don't know the name of their group right off the top of my head, but
100X. It's called 100X now.
So they all stepped down, which for us was a very appealing is the wrong word. It was very much the right thing to do. And so as we're looking at exchanges and understanding and vetting them, the way that they handle certain situations, like how Bitfinex and Binance both handled hacks that have happened to them before where they're paying back the customers. So Binance paid back a $40 million hack in 2019 completely. Bitfinex paid back a $66 million hack. It took them a while to do it, but they were able to do it. And these kinds of things show you how these exchanges operate and how they plan to operate, which gives us more confidence that if they were to be hacked, they will find a way to pay back their customers. And especially in crypto, the way that trading fees work, a lot of these bigger exchanges have a lot of money sitting on their balance sheet that they can reimburse their customers with. That's why Binance had no problem paying out $40 million. They probably didn't even bat an eye when they had to do it too.
Excellent points. And that kind of plays into just the size of an exchange and why trading with a larger counterparty, there's more incentives for them to operate ethically and to make their customers whole. And just as you said, I mean, it's happened multiple times with these certain exchanges.
Yep. And it's always different, right? Like I don't know the $40 million hack, but Binance has been hacked multiple times where it's not necessarily like a drain out of the wallets where some employee goes rogue, but it's like someone manipulates one of the trading contracts and steals money from traders. And these kinds of hacks, I think, are going to continue to happen, especially as the market picks up steam.
Yeah, I think you're referring to there was an issue where a third party went a little bit rogue interacting with Binance's API. So it wasn't really their fault, but they went out of their way to help customers and make them whole as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really great to see these things. I think as a trading company, it gives us a lot of confidence, especially in Binance, the way that they've always handled these different situations. They've always put the customer first.
And that kind of plays into monitoring on-chain data as well. A good signal for measuring an exchange is the way that they analyze incoming Bitcoin. So if an exchange doesn't use a chain analysis tool, then that means that they're not going out of their way to stop dirty Bitcoin and money laundering from happening on their exchange. And without that, it kind of gives a green light for regulators around the world to press a little bit firmer and potentially investigate. So we like to see significant anti-money laundering initiatives at the exchanges. And you can also even monitor some of the transactions going in to the exchange to verify that, to make sure that you don't see Bitcoin coming in from dark markets or previous hacks of other exchanges throughout history, smaller ones.
Well said. I think one of the more recent things in the news is the OKX founder, or one of the key holders of their multi-sig withdrawal wallets, actually ended up in jail. And because of that, they're unable to process withdrawals. So if we were affected by that, how did we handle it? I think is one of the questions. And then also, if that did happen to another exchange, how would we handle it?
So we were not affected by that. And I don't think the guy got arrested. He was just detained for questioning, which maybe that's the same thing. But that is really, so we employed all of that framework that we just talked about, and OKX did not fit the requirements just because of their relationship with the jurisdictions that kind of sit outside of our understanding, particularly China. Yep. And they also have a long track record of faking volume at their exchange.
So another data point on this too, we don't ever put all of our capital in any single exchange. So our risk is spread out among exchanges. And because of our relationships with different counterparties and Fireblocks being one of them, we're able to establish certain relationships that allow us to continue to operate even if funds were locked in an exchange for an extended period of time.
Good point. It's also important to note that everyone did get their money out of OKX. They were still able to trade. So even if one of the exchanges that is, you know, more notable and meets all the requirements, if that did happen, to Russ's point, we would still be able to continue to trade, but it still it does impact some of your liquidity. So that's why we're always trying to avoid it. But we still think that the outcome of the OKX situation was far better than, you know, it could have gone.
Yep, totally.
Another question. Let's say that all of these risk mitigation techniques that we've employed don't work, and there's an event with a counterparty where we lose a significant amount of, or access to a significant amount of funds. What would happen to the company, and what can lenders expect over the long term?
So the first thing that we would do, just like how Binance and Bitfinex operate, is if we had capital on our balance sheet to pay back whatever was lost, we would be using our own capital to pay out our lenders as their notes become mature. For the most part, our risk models and the way that we spread risk out amongst counterparties, and also depending on trades, everything that we've done, we have the ability to trade out of most of these situations. And so it would take a catastrophic event for us to actually have to go to the next step, which would be actually filing Chapter 11, in which we would be going through the court system to make everybody whole to the best of our ability.
Right. And in that situation, there is no debt seniority amongst all of our lenders. There are some special situations for shorter term loans where they would have seniority. These would be larger crypto banks. But in that situation, that kind of worst case scenario, there is no seniority. And currently, of the operating team, roughly 25% of that capital is lent to the company by the operating team. So we're all in it together. If you step out further, 50% of the capital is lent to the company by close friends and family. So ultimately, all of these people, we have significant stake and sweat in the operations, and we would all be going through the Chapter 11 in a pro rata fashion, where it would be distributed based on how much was lent to the company.
Beautifully said. And I think I've said this before, the biggest thing that we're looking at here is, like, it's all about risk management. So to get to Chapter 11, everything that we've built, everything that we've done, the way that we analyze and measure risk, that scenario would only come in a total catastrophe. We're talking like AWS gets hacked and like 4 out of the 5 major exchanges go down in that kind of a situation. I don't really see it happening any other way, just based on the way that we have set up our business and the way that we trade. It would take, you know, coordinated effort of hackers going through multiple exchanges that just seems almost illogical and impossible to pull off. We don't have significant amounts of capital locked in any particular account that they could just pull money out of instantaneously. So everything that we've set up, everything that we've built has been to protect us from this. At the base layer of our risk modeling, this is the first thing that we look at, is, you know, how do we protect from counterparty risk? How do we protect from a hack? How do we protect from a black swan event? I think a great example of this was in March in the liquidity crisis. Bitcoin dropped 50% in about 24 hours. And we were on a Google Meet. I don't know what time it was, but it was the quant team, and we're all on laughing because of how well we were doing. And the whole world is on fire, and we're sitting there with the team, and I can still see everybody's face, and we're just smiling like little children, because everything that we built, everything that we worked on, everything that we did was all knowing that that was going to happen. And everything that we did worked out exactly how we wanted it to.
Beautiful. Okay, so the next set of questions is just around general topics of trading, and how does a prop firm, or anyone for that matter, earn money or earn a yield on their Bitcoin?
And this is a great question. I think there's two ways to look at it. You can break down trading at a base level into what you would call like a probabilistic trade and a deterministic trade. So a deterministic trade is where, you know, I'm standing at the store and I can buy this banana for a dollar, and I'm on the phone with somebody who's telling me they're willing to buy this banana for $1.10. So all I do is I buy the banana for a dollar and I sell it to them for $1.10, and I've immediately made 10 cents with no risk. So this is deterministic. There was zero risk of me losing money on that transaction. I already had a place to buy and a place to sell where I made money. Probabilistic would be, you know, you're at the same store, it's a dollar for the banana, and you think that tomorrow there's going to be a shortage of bananas, and so the price is going to go up. And so you buy bananas today thinking that tomorrow the price will be up. So as a trading firm, we actually participate in both sides. So we do probabilistic and deterministic trading. Probabilistic trading would be like in Bitcoin or in stocks, maybe you look at the 20-day crossing the 30-day and you say that, you know, this has a 60% chance of continuing to go upwards. And that's a super simplified version of it. You know, maybe you throw some machine learning in there and a bunch of other buzzwords that I'm sure you guys have heard before. And then deterministic is actually one of the more beautiful things in the Bitcoin market, because as Kagan keeps saying, there's a strong need for cash and a lack of cash in this market. So there's a lot of places where you can actually lend out capital to other traders through an exchange where everything's collateralized, everything's within an ecosystem, and you're able to earn significant amounts of capital by supplying liquidity to the market. So this would be going on an exchange, using BitMEX as an example. You could buy Bitcoin, send it to BitMEX, and just go short the Bitcoin perpetual contract. And right now you get paid about 3 bips a day. I think it annualizes to about 9% per year. I'd have to double check the math, but that's a great return. All you have to do is buy Bitcoin, send it to a single address, and put one position on, and you never have to touch it again. You make 9% on your money. And so there's all kinds of opportunities like this in crypto that make for incredible deterministic trades if you understand the counterparty risk. And I think that's the biggest thing for us that we look at is, okay, there's a reason why this trade is so good sometimes, because the counterparty risk is so large. And so you have to find certain edge or insurance or be able to hedge out certain risks in order to make, you know, larger than 9% returns.
Right, because generally the market is quite efficient. And so yes, if you can borrow, if a bank can borrow, you know, from the Fed at 0%, basically, and there's a way to make 9%, if the risks are manageable, the money will flow there naturally. That's what the market does. So what the market is saying is that, you know, there's not enough people that understand the risks, or that the risks are too high to earn mm-hmm. that specific return. When someone needs to borrow dollars to increase their position or their desire to be long, we can provide those dollars. And so we can provide them in a various amounts of ways, but using Bitcoin as collateral is a great way to do it. Yep. And this kind of ties into some of the other questions around what is the future of the lending markets look like when Bitcoin is at $500,000 or $1 million?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great question. I think, Kagan, you're probably even better to answer this than me, but it really comes down to the fact that as Bitcoin matures, more and more banks are going to get comfortable with the ecosystem, and we're going to see more and more large counterparties come into the picture with larger amounts of capital willing to make less and less money as rates get more and more competitive. Right now, in general, the market is just pricing all of crypto as risky, which is why, you know, baseline rates all over the place are like 10%, because we're just in a place where this exchange could get shut down tomorrow or get hacked. And so 10% isn't a wild number, where if you told your grandma she could make 10% a year in her savings account, she might lose her mind because that's insane. It's almost unheard of. I could probably look it up. I don't think we've had rates like that in savings accounts in 50 plus years.
Yeah. Well, I can add some more insights there because I have been speaking directly with our banking partners and different liquidity providers. And it's really interesting to see kind of the way things are shaping up because we're not quite there yet, meaning getting a dollar loan with Bitcoin as your collateral. So that would mean I give a bank $1 million in Bitcoin and they give me a loan for half the value. That loan, like Russ said, is still going to cost you upwards of 10%. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the risk reward profile, you gave them twice as much value as the loan. And you're still paying 10%. So the risks are quite low when you look at it kind of in a vacuum. But especially, and then you zoom out and you look at, or you know what, actually, I would say the risks are quite low when you look at it amongst other asset classes, because when you go buy a house, you're getting 20x leverage. You're putting up $100,000 and they're giving you $2 million.
They go even higher nowadays. The FHA loans, they'll do like 3% down. So it's like 30% or 30x leverage.
So when you look at kind of, there is a lot of factors at play, and I'm not going to pretend like we can cover them all on this podcast, but it really is just homes are essentially backstopped by the government. They just have a significant track record, but they're not liquid. Bitcoin's is pretty liquid. So I really think to the question, as Bitcoin becomes more liquid and it's just going to be kind of that gradually, the gradually then suddenly type of curve where we need more banking participants to get comfortable with Bitcoin as collateral. And as the markets mature, that means that if you end up not being able to pay back that dollar loan, they can go immediately to the market, liquidate the Bitcoin, and they've taken on little risk. So I really do expect the dollar lending rates to come down significantly over time. And it ultimately will be good for the market because that means people can express their views much cheaper, because ultimately that's what people are doing when they're taking on a position. And in the derivatives world, I forget the multiple, but there's quadrillions of leverage taken out on the markets. And so right now, Bitcoin really kind of has a bottleneck, essentially. There really isn't enough capital to supply these individuals and institutions.
This brings up a great data point but Michael Saylor would be a great data point here. I don't know if it makes sense on the FAQ.
That's what brought this all to my attention in a firm way. Please go into that.
So a great example of like capital flowing into this market and kind of the maturity of it was MicroStrategy buying Bitcoin. They bought a large position worth of Bitcoin. Then they went to the market and actually said, "Hey guys, we want to borrow $500 million to purchase Bitcoin." Not only did the market, one, loan them the money to do it at less than 1% on the note, they also did it oversubscribed, and I think they got over $600 million worth of subscription for them to just go purchase Bitcoin. So that just goes to show, one, rates in the actual market are super cheap. We're talking sub 1% on, I think like a 5-year note, maybe a 4-year term. It's like 2025, I think the notes expired. And they raised $500 million just to purchase Bitcoin. So there's a ton of capital that's out there that wants Bitcoin, that wants to be in this market, that wants to loan money to this market, but they don't know how. And they don't necessarily have the vehicles to do that yet. But as time goes on, as we get the stamp of approval from government officials, from governments, from people like Michael Saylor and some of the, you know, more well-known tech people, I think we're going to see more and more inflow into this market. That's just going to be better and better for us in general. Definitely makes a case for $500,000, $1 million Bitcoin when we're able to get leverage a lot cheaper.
And just to reiterate the point you made, he borrowed dollars for 1% a year. Right now in the crypto world, with that type of leverage, it's well above 10%.
Yep.
So that disparity, that there's many factors at play as to why that is cheaper. They are an established company and they have other lines of revenue rather than just holding Bitcoin. But that gap will close. And another example is on Interactive Brokers, your cost to get leverage is around 2%, 2.5%. And people are putting on positions in assets that are far less liquid than Bitcoin with those rates.
So, well, and far more volatile too.
Right.
Like Bitcoin really isn't as volatile as some of the micro cap and smaller cap stocks in the stock market.
It's very fascinating to kind of, I think you would agree, Russ, the longer we run this business, the more access to information we've gained. And working with these really large banks and custodians, you really start to see the progress that's being made, but also how much there is, how much work there is to go. Ultimately, there's so much untapped potential. These banks really are still working with their hands tied behind their backs. And once those handcuffs come off, I really think you're going to start to see a lot of capital formation in crypto.
Yep. And it's really cool to be here where we are now, because we're very much seeing it happen. I think this year, 2020, was a really big year for it, with all these traditional companies, even PayPal announcing something with crypto. And I think we're just going to see more and more of that as time goes on. You want to do our last two questions? We totally went off on a beautiful tangent there. So we see that you added ETH to the app. Do you have plans to add more, and I'm going to do air quotes here, shit coins to the Tantra app to offer interest rates on them?
Excellent question. So we added ETH because ETH has a significant track record. It's liquid, and it was a very easy transition for our strategies to start trading. And ultimately, we want to reduce the volatility of our revenue and our profit as a company so that we can better guarantee the interest rates that we are offering. So at the end of the day, if we're able to generate yield from ETH and USDC, then that means a more stable company for all of our lenders, including Bitcoin.
Well said. But you didn't answer the question. Are we going to add more shitcoins?
Well, internally, we do have a USD product, so we might roll that out to the public. But at this time, we do not plan to add any more shitcoins, because ultimately, ETH and Bitcoin have, they're really the only assets that have the market structure where we can make a significant amount of money. And I think Russ would agree here. We have some biases. We really are Bitcoiners and Ethereans, and we do want to kind of limit the amount of noise for our lenders.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think we all as a team collectively agree in both roadmaps for Bitcoin and Ethereum. We see a future for both of them. And as other technologies come online that we're paying attention to, if they show merit and promise and market validation, then we are flexible enough to add them. But as of right now, we very much believe in Bitcoin and Ethereum. We see a future and a world that exists with them and not without them.
And to that point, as far as the work that was required to take in ETH through the app, it really was not a large amount of work, because with our hot wallet provider, Fireblocks, I think it took Russ a couple days to turn on the ETH API. And so as of today, we could turn on a bunch of other coins. But to Russ's point, we don't want to, we really do want to focus on ETH and Bitcoin. And at the end of the day, the trading opportunities with them are much higher.
Yep. Well, and much more mature. It's hard to, like, let's say we opened up Cardano, right? There's not as many markets. There's not as much volume. There's not as many opportunities. And so we're not really able to offer the same kind of rates, which that would be a distraction for us.
Yeah.
And so we very much, as a small team too, I think we very much want to narrow our focus.
Bitcoin and Ethereum also have, well, at least Bitcoin in a more formal sense does have the green light for most regulators. Ethereum mm-hmm. is registered with the SEC for the Grayscale fund. And that is a huge green light from regulators. So we'd like that as well. We don't need to be taking any risks as far as offering exposure to different types of coins that might be deemed as securities.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of reasons as to why you wouldn't want to offer shit coins. We don't want to spend our time trying to understand some crazy new fork that's happening.
Yep.
Ultimately, as all the Bitcoiners are very familiar with, the lack of change is very comforting for us. And
yep.
ETH is kind of on the outer rim of that, because certainly they do have a more riskier approach to the way they change the protocol. And that's why at the end of the day, the amount of ETH that we've accepted as a company is significantly smaller. It's about
I would say it's like 1-5.
Yeah, it's a 1-5 ratio. So we're still mm-hmm. accepting ETH, but ultimately it is a smaller ratio to the obligations of the company in relation to Bitcoin.
Well said. Well, I think that does it for all of our FAQs. Any last words, anything you want to tag on before we hit the road here?
No, I think that's it. Happy to get this done. And I know that there's always something that inhibits our ability to do the podcast. So it's remarkable, honestly. Internet outage, a service provider outage. So I hope everyone at home knows that we're really working against the forces of nature to get these things out. And so for that, you should be thankful.
Well, and we thank you for listening. Thanks for Absolutely. Tuning in. And please continue to send questions our way. Any feedback, it's all super valuable to us. We continue to grow as a company, and we want to grow with you guys in mind, providing you services that you want and need. So thanks again for listening. We'll catch you on the next one. See ya.
Bye.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, consider leaving us a positive review, and sharing us with your friends. Previously only open to accredited investors, Tantra Labs will soon be open to the public, offering 12% interest on your Bitcoin or Ethereum. That's higher than our competitors and much higher than your bank. To learn more or to sign up for our beta waitlist, visit tantralabs.io. Thanks for listening.